Well, Jeff, the book was, it was so good. I loved it. So many great stories. But I think what I was most impressed with is the positivity and the energy and the enthusiasm for what you do and have done for all these years. That's right there on every page.
Thank you. Thank you. The title of the book is My Extraordinary Life in Television, and it has been. I've been blessed.
It's worked out maybe better than if you would become a doctor.
Yeah, my grandparents, may they rest in peace, you know, they wouldn't agree with you.
Your grandfather and your dad, they kind of supported your passion right behind the scenes and in a stealth fashion.
They did. They both did. They were wonderful. They were wonderful. My grandmother was very strong. And so my grandfather knew what to talk to her about and what not to talk to her about. And he chose not to mention this to her, but he knew. He knew.
It must have been that generation, though, that you had gone through the Depression and just wanted to make sure that their children and their grandchildren had something secure and stable that would see them through any tough times.
And I think that as history has it, young Jewish boys, especially on the East and West Coast, you know, were expected to become doctors or lawyers. That was just part of the family tradition. So I don't think they were ever disappointed, though. I don't think I disappointed anybody.
So you write in the book that you always knew, or at least knew from a young age, you wanted to be involved in television, but specifically, you wanted to direct the Oscars. What was it about that program that was that light that drew you to it?
Well, you know, the book tells you from the beginning when I was 5 years old, my dad brought home that first box with a piece of glass on the front of it. But I always loved television. And the more I watched television, the more I got interested in sort of music and variety and all that. And then as I got into sort of the junior high school, senior high school years and started watching more and more television, I used to watch the Oscars, and Miss America was another show that I thought was big and fascinating. But the Oscars was like, the Oscars was all about Hollywood and the motion picture industry and big stars and big, big, big. And I just loved watching that show. And I thought to myself, I mean, how does all that stuff happen? You know, who puts all that together? And who makes that 3 hours just, it seemed like it flows. It always looks good on television, you know, when you're home watching it. And I just dreamed about, I knew I wanted to be a producer and a director. And I knew the types of shows that I wanted to do. And I wanted to build to the Academy Awards, which I think was sort of the pinnacle, you know, of all music sort of variety award show things. And it was just something that I dreamed about. I started dreaming about it in junior high school. And man, I finally made my dream come true.
And you followed the path that your parents suggested. You started school, I think, in pre-med, but quickly switched, I think, into the film program. But then you realized it wasn't film that was your passion, that it was television.
You're absolutely right. I didn't want to disappoint anybody, so I graduated high school. I got accepted to USC as a pre-med student. And about halfway through the first semester, I drove to school one day and I went right to the counselor's office. You know, I couldn't dissect another frog, you know, or look at any more blood. And I went to the counselor and I said, I got to change my major. I'm just not happy. Anyway, she said, what do you want to do? I said, television. She said, we don't have a television school here. She said, the only television school that I know in the country right now is UCLA. So I got in my car and I drove over to UCLA and I got to see the dean of the film and television school. Nice guy. And it was too late in the semester for me to start there. So I went back to the counselor at USC and she said, we've got a film department. You can get into the film school. And my parents paid a lot of money. USC was a private college. They paid a lot of money. And I didn't want to disappoint them anyway. So I transferred over to the film school. And after a couple of weeks in the film school, I said to myself, you know, this is not what you want. You want television. You know, and I went back to UCLA and the dean said, hey, you can sit in on any class that you want to sit in on. And then next semester, you can start here. You know, you can be a full-time student. So that's what I did, you know. And were my parents disappointed? In the beginning, a little bit. But as they saw my growth and they saw what I wanted to do and they saw my passion for what I was doing, they understood and they got on board.
Well, and you also had some pretty good family support in the person of one Uncle Monty that the rest of us know as the great Monty Hall.
Yeah, my grandpa set that up for me. You know, Monty and his family moved from Canada to New York. And Monty was hosting a show called Video Village. I think it was on CBS. And then he came up with Let's Make a Deal and sold it to NBC and moved out to Los Angeles. And one day my grandfather said, we're having a big family sort of get together and you're going to meet your Uncle Monty. And I said, who's Uncle Monty? And, you know, he told me. And anyway, he put the two of us together and Monty opened the door for me. He couldn't have been more generous and kinder. And he opened the door. He said, I'll open the door for you and then, you know, do whatever you want. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, he got my foot in the door. You know, people say nepotism is, a lot of people poo-poo it, but it sure worked for me.
I love the story. You were doing cue cards and you got very good at it, but then you saw an opportunity and you went out on your own, breaking away from the king of cue cards in LA at the time and starting your own business.
Yes. I that was the door that Monty opened for me. He set up a meeting for me with this guy who owned a cue card company, had a monopoly, was the only company in town. And so I went to work for him. And after about 6 months, I realized that people were really there were a lot of disgruntled employees that I learned about quickly. But there were a lot of producers that were unhappy with the way this guy scheduled people and his billing and all that. So I thought to myself, well, the only other monopoly that I'm aware of is the Ma Bell telephone company, you know. Everybody had a Bell telephone.
Right.
So I thought, I'll try and start my own cue card company. And I did, and we became very successful very quickly. And it gave me the opportunity, once I got the cue card company up and running, it gave me the opportunity to move to the next plateau that I wanted to move to, which was becoming an associate director on a variety show.
We're talking with Jeff Margolis here on Downtown. Tommy Smothers has always been a hero of mine. I was so fortunate to get to talk with him a little over a year ago, and he played such a big role because of the confidence that they had in you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. When I started the cue card company with the fellas that I started with, there were four other guys, and you know, I'd been holding cue cards for Tommy Smothers, for Tom and Dick Smothers, but I was sort of Tommy's cue card guy. And every Friday night when the show finished shooting, he always used to have people up to his dressing room. And so one Friday I sort of asked if I could join in. He said, sure, come on up. So I went up and I said, can I pull you aside and talk to you for a minute? And he said, yeah. So we went into another room, he closed the door, he said, what's up? And I said, I have an idea. And I said, I want to start my own cue card company. And he said, that is the best idea I've heard. He said, how much money do you need? And I said to him, no, that's not why I'm telling you about it. I just wanted to know what you thought. And he said, I think that within 6 months, you'll have 25% of the business. And he said in a year you'll have 25-30% of the business. So I said, well, okay. I said, I'll let you know what we decide to do. And so I went back to him and I said, we're starting the company. He said, great. You can, the first show you'll have is the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. You can go pick up the script on Monday. I said, really? He said, yep. And so, you know, all of us guys, there were five of us total. We called this guy who owned the Cue Card Company. And we said, thank you very much for the opportunity. We're moving on. And we picked up the script Monday in the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour production office, and we were on our way. And thank you, Tommy Smothers. May he rest in peace. I'll be forever grateful to him for giving us the opportunity to get started. And Tommy was wrong. He said in a year, 25-30% of the business. In 6 months, we had about 60% of the business. That's how much that this guy who had the monopoly was really, you know, disliked by people. So anyway, and we were well on our way, and the company was doing very well. We were very successful. So it gave me the opportunity to go sit in control rooms and watch directors direct and listen to producers talk about, you know, what they needed to do. And I learned an awful lot. And I met producers named Chris Beard and Alan Bly. And Alan Bly and I became very, well, they actually didn't start the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Another set of producers, Saul Ilson and Ernie Chambers, who I mentioned in the book as well. Anyway, so I met Alan Bly and Chris Beard, and Alan and I became very friendly, and he was a real mentor of mine. And he said to me, Chris and I just got a new show. We're doing a show on CBS. We're starting in a couple weeks called the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour. And he said, I'd like you to be the associate director. And I said, well, who's the director? And he said, a gentleman named Art Fisher. And I said, oy, are you kidding? Art Fisher, he's like, you know, I mean, he was legendary, but he was legendary for being one of the biggest assholes in the business. You know, pardon my French, but I mean, he was a screamer, you know, and he was just a very difficult, difficult guy. And I said to Alan, I said, I mean, does Art know that you want me to be the associate director? I mean, he picks his own guys. And Alan said, don't worry, you're the associate director and I'll take care of Art. So that was it. I had my first associate directing job on a network primetime show.
But you were the Art whisperer, though, in many ways. You learned to work with him. And part of that was, first of all, just doing the job really well to the point where he ended up trusting you and you established a good working relationship.
It didn't take very long. I mean, I said to him in the very beginning, he made it very difficult for me. And I said to him, look, you know, I'm only here to help you. If you're going to treat me like shit, I'm out of here. You know, but if you take advantage of what I have to offer, it'll be good for both of us. And so, you know, he gave me an opportunity, and he realized how beneficial I was to him. I mean, I really, really made his life very much easier because I was so intent on becoming a director. I never did anything to sort of try and prove myself that I could do the job that he was doing or I could do it any better or differently or anything. But I knew that, you know, I set my goal to be a director. And he knew that I wanted to be a director. And so as an assistant director, let me get rid of this. I'm just going to push a button here. As an associate director, because I wanted to direct, I was really able to be helpful to him. And that's how we became friends and developed this great relationship. And it was all good. It was all good. You know, he would say something to me and I would say to him, really, Art, you're going to go that way? You're going to go down that road?
And then you got your chance to direct with a guy who'd been in the record business as a promo man, and then had a big hit on his own, and they decided he can be a TV star, the Tony Orlando and Don show. And it sure sounds like it was a good lesson for you also in being a psychologist and that part of the director's job.
Well, it was. I think directors are always, you know, best friends and big brothers or big sisters and, you know, psychologists and therapists and everything else. But I got, you know, Fred Silverman was the head of CBS at the time. And Fred Silverman always used to come into the control room on Sonny and Cher. And, you know, he was aware of what I was doing. And his wife said to him, you know, Fred was in Los Angeles and his wife was in New York. Fred used to travel back and forth. And his wife said to him, I went to a club with my girlfriends the other night. We saw this Puerto Rican guy and two black girls that call themselves Tony Orlando and Donna. And they were fantastic. You got to see them. So anyway, next time Fred flew back to New York, he went to this club and they were performing. And, you know, Fred Silverman was a star maker. He was at all three networks and everything. Anyway, he made a deal with Tony Orlando and Don. They had he gave them their own show. He gave them four shows as a replacement series during the summer. And Saul Ilsner and her Chambers, who I mentioned earlier, Fred hired them to produce the show and asked them to meet with me. And we all met and loved each other, fell in love, and they hired me to do Tony Orlando and Don. That was my first network primetime directing gig. 1974, Tony Orlando and Don.
And you spent a lot of time giving Tony the confidence to go out there and perform.
Well, like you said, I mean, he was a record company executive. And, you know, as the story goes, if I remember correctly, somebody brought Tony an idea for a record and he really liked it, but didn't know what he was going to do with it. And some time went by and apparently Dionne Warwick was in a studio. He was in a building in New York and Dionne Warwick was in a studio downstairs. And Dionne Warwick had these two backup singers with her. And Tony thought, you know what? I really like this song. I want to sing this song. Anyway, he went to the two backup singers. He said, you want to help me? I'm going to do this thing on my own and see if I can, because I don't have an artist that I can give this to. So anyway, they made a demo. It was a song called Knock Three Times, which was Tony Orlando and Don's first giant hit before Ty.
But if I remember right, they billed themselves only as Don because he didn't want to hurt his reputation at the record company if the thing bombed.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Anyway, listen, when Tony got the show, Tony and the girls were, I mean, they never expected to be on television. And, you know, Tony and I are pretty much around the same age. And Tony said to me, hey, man, I know this is your first directing gig, but I know you've been around for a lot of years. I know you know what's going on. And I don't know shit. You know, he said, You gotta get me through this, man. I mean, my name's on the show. It's Tony Orlando and Don. And you really gotta help me. And he relied on me a lot for everything. And, you know, I was happy to help him. And the more I helped him, the more it helped me. You know, when you have to talk and help somebody figure something out, you're really sort of figuring it out on your own as well. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was all good. And, you know, Saul Ilsen and Ernie Chambers are very strong producers. And so they were there for Tony as well. But Tony relied on them a lot as far as the writing was concerned. As far as, you know, being on screen and being in front of millions of Americans on television, he relied on me to make him look good and sound good.
How did you get the gig directing the Richard Pryor live concert performance?
Wow. It's a really a long story. I'll try and make it short. when we were doing weekly variety shows for networks, you used to have to edit your shows at the network. And then this guy named Bob Seidenglanz thought, I'm going to open an editing facility. Maybe there's so much stuff that, you know. Anyway, he opened a company, and now we had a place to go other than the network to edit. Bob Seidenglanz was a very successful business guy, and he opened this editing facility, and then he opened another editing facility, and I worked at all of them. And there was a gentleman named Bill Sargent, who was apparently the first guy that shot a television special or a television show and put it on film and put it in a theater. And so I don't know how he found out about Richard Pryor. You know, like I said, the story is so long. The end of the story, the short version of it, is that the guys who were running the editing company, Bill Sargent went to them and said, do you want to invest money? I have an opportunity to do a special with Richard Pryor. I want to make the first stand-up comedian ever to be on film in theaters. I want to make a movie with Richard Pryor. And they said, we'll pay for everything. We'll invest all the money, but you got to use our director. And so Sargent said, okay, you know, fine. It's fine with me. You want to put up all the money? So they came to me and they said, hey, Jeff, you want to one of these days direct movies, don't you? And I said, yeah, one of these days, you know, I'll do a movie. They said, how about now? And I said, what are you talking about? They said, we're putting up the money for Richard Pryor live in concert. It's going to be the first stand-up comedian ever to make a full-length feature movie. So I said, yeah, I'm in. And that's sort of how it came about. And before I knew it, I was directing Richard Pryor live in concert.
Now, you worked a lot with Dick Clark, and I love the stories about him in the book, too. He could be a tough guy to work for. He knew what he wanted, but he also knew what he had in his working relationship with you.
Yeah, I love Dick. I loved it. He was fantastic. I mean, he was a producer who worked on both sides of the camera. And so he knew both sides of the camera. And he knew what he wanted and how to get it. And it was tough working for him until you proved yourself to him, which I did very early on. I mean, he had this big NBC special, and it was really the first special that I ever did. It was called Dick Clark's Good Old Days. And it was a 2-hour special, and it was Dick Clark was the host, and Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon were the co-hosts. And we did all the wraparounds and a lot of the musical performances on the beach in Malibu. One of the most beautiful beaches in the world. So it was like an on location. It was like making a little movie. And anyway, I did that special for Dick. I couldn't believe that he and this gentleman who was working for him, producing shows for him, named Al Schwartz, who is one of my dear, dear friends to this day. Al Schwartz, I think, said to Dick Clark, you got to meet this guy, Jeff Margolis. You know, he's doing Tony Orlando and Don, and he's done this, and he did Richard Pryor live, and blah, blah, blah. You know, gave him a whole list of my credits, and Dick said, I want to meet him. And so Dick hired me to do that show, and I pretty much did every special that Dick did for years and years and years. And in 1981, he asked me to direct the American Music Awards, which was his big, you know, I mean, that was the music award show that was butting heads with the Grammy Awards. Those were the two big music award shows. And so Dick hired me to do that. And I did it for like 26 years. I did the American Music Awards.
You worked a number of times through the years with Carol Burnett and Julie Andrews. And the story that you tell in the book about Blake Edwards coming on the set. I think that tells a lot about what's made you successful, your willingness to step back and say, hey, if Blake Edwards wants to direct the comedy segments, that's fantastic.
I was so honored to have him in the rehearsal hall with us. You know, Julie and Carol sat me down once we had started, and I had done a lot of work with both of them. But one of the big things that I did was Julie Andrews had a special on CBS called One Step into Spring, which we actually shot in London. And it was the first time that I had ever been to London. And so Julie and I became really close. I had done a number of things with her. So they sat me down one day and they said to me, listen, we love you. That's why you're here. You're the best. And Julie said, my husband, Blake, is probably the best comedy director in film. And Carol and I thought maybe he could stop by and just sort of look at the comedy that we're doing and maybe he'd have some suggestions. And would that be okay with you? We don't want to, you know. I said, be okay with me? Are you kidding? Call him now. Get him down here. You know. So you know, Blake came in and introduced himself and said, listen, this is your show. I don't want to get in your way. I'm just here to help the comedy sketches. I'm here to help the girls with the comedy sketches. And if I can stage the comedy, I'll check with you. And if it's okay for your cameras, fine. If you need me to change something, I'm happy to change it for you. And I thought, is this really happening, Janice? Blake Edwards is in my rehearsal hall directing Carol Burnett and Julie Andrews and asking me if it's okay. I couldn't believe it. He was the nicest guy and he made the comedy better. Absolutely. You know, the girls had all the respect in the world for him and he made the comedy better. And he did say to me every time, is it okay for you, Jeff? And if I needed something changed, I said, it would be better for me if you could just have Julie say this line, you know, when she's, before she walks across the room. He said, no problem. And he fixed it.
You finally.
And that was my experience with Blake Edwards. And I was so thankful that I had that opportunity.
You finally got that opportunity to direct the Oscars and it might be my favorite story in the book. It's in the foreword to it. The gift that your dad sent you because you had talked about the challenge of directing a long award show like that.
Yeah, yeah. I started directing live shows in the 70s. I did a thing right after I don't remember the exact year. It was either 74 or 75. Saul and Ernie were asked by CBS to produce a show, which is no longer on the air. It was called America's Junior Miss. And it was the forerunner to the Miss America pageant. Mm. And it was done in Mobile, Alabama, of all places. And it was a 2-hour live show on CBS. Saul and Ernie were asked to produce it. And we were doing Tony Orlando and Don together. And they asked me if I wanted to direct it. I said, yeah, I do. I'd never done a live show before. But so before I went to Mobile, Alabama, I said to my parents, I was having dinner with them one night. And I said, you know, I just have to figure out how to make sure I go to the bathroom before the show goes live on the air. And I hope I can hold it in till the show's over. And my dad sort of heard that. So I'm in Mobile, Alabama. We're about to do the show. We just finished the dress rehearsal. So I'm making all my notes and everything, sitting in the truck, getting ready to do the live show. And I get a tap on the shoulder from one of the production assistants, hands me a little box, like a jewelry box, like you get a ring in. And I thought, what is this? And I looked on the top and there was a card on it said, to Jeff from Dad. I thought, oh, how sweet. And I opened the box and I opened it up and there was a cork in there. It was a wine cork. And it had America's Junior Miss written on it and the date. and a note. And I opened up the note. My dad said, "Jeff, we had the discussion about going to the bathroom. If you feel like you have to go to the bathroom, shove this up your ass and you can hold it in."
And then that became a tradition, right?
Every live television show that I ever directed or produced, but directed, my dad sent me a cork. Every time I'd feel a tap on my shoulder, it'd be a production assistant to hand me this little box. Everybody on the crew always waited for me to open that box. I always did it on headset. I read the card from my dad. Everybody knew. It was so much fun. I have all the corks.
Oh, that's fantastic. So the Oscars were just on this weekend. I thought it was a very good telecast. I thought Jimmy Kimmel was an excellent host. Is that show, from your experience, is that the ultimate test of a director in a live television setting?
All award shows are pretty much, they all have a life of their own, but they're all difficult. It's organized chaos, you know, and they're really, really difficult shows to get on the air. You know, people at home watch it and they have no idea what goes on. The Oscars probably takes more time than a lot of the other shows because it's always been the queen mum of all the award shows. You know, it's the biggest award show on the air. And there are a lot of pieces to putting in together, and it takes a long time. I would spend 4 months doing the Oscars, and the last couple weeks of that show is 24/7. You just don't sleep. You know, if you're lucky, you get to take a nap occasionally. And, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, for example, the week before the Oscars, all of his shows on the air are reruns because he's so busy working with the writers on all of the pieces that he has to do on that show, starting with the opening monologue, which is very difficult for the host because that sets the tone for the evening. The host monologue sets the tone for the evening. I thought Jimmy did a great job the other night. I think Jimmy's great. And I thought he really rose to the occasion. Every time he was on camera, I thought he was good. I really enjoyed the show. I thought that the producers brought a little bit of the glitz and glamour back to the show the other night.
Now, did you, am I right about this? Were you the one who instituted the idea that they brought back this year of having actors, former winners, talk about the nominees in the acting categories?
No, that wasn't me.
Ah.
That wasn't me.
I'm going to give you credit for it anyway, Jeff.
Well, I did some other things for the Oscars that were really good, and other award shows do them now. The first year I did it, Alan Carr and I sort of produced the show, and I directed the show, and we came up with the idea of when the presenter opens the envelope, don't say the winner is, say, and the Oscar goes to, because just to be nominated, you're a winner. So we didn't want to single out one person, even though only one person get the award. So we thought, and the Oscar goes to. Anyway, every award show picked that up, and every award show does that. The other thing was the Academy Awards, every year they sort of honored one actor who had passed away, actor or actress who had passed away during the year. And I said to Alan, you know, there's so many, this show, the Academy Awards, is about the movie industry. It's about everybody that's involved. I mean, they give awards for costume design and makeup and art direction and sound editing and all that. Why not make a montage of people who are in the business who passed away? And that's what we did. And, you know, it lasted about 3 minutes and it was very moving. It was a really emotional, I mean, there's a lot of emotion on the Oscars. You know, there are surprise winners. I mean, there are surprise winners sometimes, and their speeches become very emotional. So there are emotional moments on all the award shows. But for some reason, when we did that 3-minute montage in memoriam package, there was just everybody, there was silence. at the end of it. You know, there was no applause, there was nothing. And it was, so anyway, that stuck. The idea of Alan Carr and I came up with the idea of not having a host and having the presenters sort of be the host of each award that they were presenting.
Right.
But I thought that the other night, the idea of bringing the five former, you know, actors back, I thought that was a really, really good idea, and it worked beautifully. It was executed beautifully. I really enjoyed the show the other night. I don't have anything negative to say about it, really.
You have so many great stories about hosts and Oscar presenters, and as someone who's a huge fan of Paul Newman, if it was possible to love him more, I think you made me do that.
Oh, God, he was the best. He was just the best. You know, he would come on as a presenter, and I would get to, I always talk to all the presenters and just introduce myself and then, you know, sort of turned it over to the stage manager to tell him what to do. But Paul Newman, the first time I introduced myself to him and I said, you know, I'm the director and thank you for being here. And yeah, the award that you're going to present is so on and so on. And now I'm going to turn you over to my stage managers and they'll tell you what to do. And he said, hey, wait a minute. Wait. You're the director. You're supposed to tell me what to do. I'm used to directors telling me what to do. So I said, oh, okay. Because, you know, it was my plan anyway. So the stage managers, I said, Mr. Newman wants me to show him what to do. So anyway, I did. You know, I said, you're going to enter from stage right over here and you're going to take this walk down to the podium and the prompter will be out there for you and you can just read right off the prompter and you don't have to worry about anything else except setting up the package so that we can see the five nominees. And I said, then you have to, somebody will come out during that package and hand you the envelope. And then when you get the cue from the stage manager, you know, say, and the Oscar goes to, open the envelope. And he thanked me very much. And he came back the next year. He came back and he said to the stage manager who brought him in to the theater and brought him backstage, he said, hey, where's that guy Margolis? He's directing the show again this year, isn't he? And they said, yeah, he is. And Newman said, bring him out here. So anyway, I went out and there was, you know, big hugs and kisses. And he said, okay, tell me what to do, boss. And, you know, he always wore his glasses. He would push them up here on his forehead or, you know, in his hair. And he had a pair of sunglasses up there. And he was looking at me and he put his elbow up on my shoulder as I was talking to him. And I thought, this guy is great, a great guy. He had so much respect for a director, you know, and I guess he had a lot of respect for me because he was always happy and he always knew who the director was. And anyway, it was another thrill. I mean, oh God, you know, as we were writing this book, my ghostwriter, a lady named Lauren Stevens, who was absolutely fantastic, she said to me, you know, Jeff, this book is only, you know, you can write volumes, you know, we've got to figure out how to, let's call this volume one. We'll call it volume one. Or in your mind, you think of this as volume one. We'll do volume two later if this book sells well.
I hope so.
So that's what we did.
Speaking of great specials and emotional moments, I don't know. There haven't been many moments I think as moving on television as the Sammy Davis Jr. special. What a great night that was.
That was probably the most memorable night ever. And anybody who was involved in the show will tell you that. As lovely and wonderful as it is to do the Oscars and to do the American Music Awards and all those other great specials, there was something about this evening. First of all, everybody who was involved, I mean, the news had come out that Sammy had throat cancer and that he didn't have very long. left on this planet. And so anybody who, you know, George Schlatter was the producer, and George and I had done a lot of shows. We were very, very friendly. Anybody George called said yes to him before he even, you know, finished inviting him. They said yes. They wanted to be there for Sammy. So, you know, ABC bought an hour special. At those times, you did star specials, they were an hour. And George went back to ABC and said, I need 90 minutes. And at that time, there were, the networks were doing a couple of major star specials that were 90 minutes. So ABC said, okay, fine. Sammy Davis Jr., 90 minutes, great. So we put together this special, and it was at the Shrine Auditorium. Again, the Shrine, my favorite place to shoot an award show or a television special. And it was just a very emotional evening, because what we decided to do was sort of build a special box, like, you know, the Queen has a box at the Palladium Theatre in London, the Queen's box up by the opera boxes, you know. And we built this special Queen's box, King's box for Sammy Davis Jr., right down on the stage, so that all the performers who came to perform could go over and give him a hug or shake his hand or give him a kiss or whatever they wanted to do. He was right there, and he was in the box with his family and some dear friends. And it was a very emotional evening, because everybody who performed performed something special for Sammy. And Michael Jackson decided that he wanted to write a song especially for Sammy. And a writer named Buzz Cohan, who Michael was knew very well, and who was a very talented writer, worked on the lyrics of the song with Michael. Michael wrote the music, and he and Buzz worked on the lyrics together. And Sammy wrote this song for, I mean, Michael wrote the song for Sammy. And as soon as he got the first eight bars out of his mouth, I mean, you just had to start crying. I mean, it was so touching. And Whitney Houston and Dionne Warwick and Goldie Hawn and Stevie Wonder. And I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And everybody came out and said, Sammy, this is for you. I'm doing this specially for you. And everybody sang their heart out or spoke their heart out. You know, Goldie Hawn told a wonderful story about how Sammy, you know, introduced her to somebody who gave her a start. And anyway, it was pretty spectacular. It was a pretty spectacular evening. And the end of the story is we shot it like a live show, and it took 2.5 hours. It was 2.5 hours. So George, who has the greatest sense of humor of all, the show went 2.5 hours. So when I finally thanked everybody in the truck and everybody on headset and everything, I came out of the truck, and the first person I saw was George Schlatter. This story's in the book. The first person I saw was George Schlatter, and he looked at me and he put his hands on my shoulders and he said, you did a great job, kid, and we'll be able to fix it all in editing. I thought to myself, is this guy serious? We just did a live event that was the most spectacular. And George saw the look on my face, and he gave me a big, you know, bear hug like he does. He said, I'm only kidding, man. It was fantastic. We don't have anything to do. What are we going to do? He said, I have a 90-minute show. ABC bought a 90-minute show. We just finished 2.5 hours. So anyway, we went to ABC the next day, of course. And George said to them, I'm going to leave you this tape to look at. In those days, you know, it was VHS tapes or whatever it was. I'm going to leave you this tape to look at. You bought a 90-minute show. I'm giving you a 2.5-hour tape to look at. You tell me what to cut. And they looked at the show, and they gave us 2.5 hours. And it was, I think, the first, you know, variety special in the history of variety specials that was ever 2.5 hours. Only award shows were 2.5 hours. Right. There was nothing to cut.
I have to ask you one last story. We've taken up way too much of your time, but I have to ask you what a thrill it was to be able to take your parents to the White House to meet the Clintons.
That was the best. You know, my dad, I used to always ask my parents if they wanted to come to a show, and they always wanted to come. And my mom would sit in the audience. My dad loved to sit in the control room and watch me work. So now Bill Clinton is president of the United States of America. And I was doing this show for Charles and Diana in London called ABC Presents a Royal Gala. We did the show for 2 years. We were about to do it for the third year, and they decided to get a divorce. So that was the end of ABC Presents a Royal Gala. But anyway, Bill Clinton had become president at the same time that Charles and Diana, somewhere around the same time. And so my good, good friend at ABC, John Hamlin, who just passed away, may he rest in peace, he was the best network executive ever. And I went to him and I said, you know, Bill Clinton loves show business. He loves Hollywood. He loves music. He loves movies, all that stuff. So we're not doing Charles and Diana. Why don't we do Bill and Hillary? Why don't we do the same thing in Washington? Let's find, you know, someplace. Anyway, we decided to do this show at Ford's Theater, the famous Ford's Theater. The first year we did it, we got everything organized. The second year we did it, one of the things we did was all the guests who came on the show, I set up a thing where before we taped the show, they went to the White House and they got to meet Bill and Hillary and have a glass of wine or a scotch with them or whatever they did, get their pictures taken. And that was a little icing on the cake for everybody who came on the show. That was something that I could do for them as the producer. I was able to do that for them. So the second year I thought, you know what? I'm going to take my mom and dad. I'm going to bring them and let them sit in the audience in this show. But they don't know it yet, but I'm going to take them to the White House. And so we were in Washington, D.C. I flew them over, put them up. They were so excited to go to the show. And I said to them, well, get ready a couple of hours early before the show. I'm going to take you to the White House. They said, what? And I said, I'm going to take you to the White House. I got a special treat for you. So before we went in to meet the president and the first lady, there was a dressed, uniformed serviceman there. And that guy would announce before anybody went in so that Bill and Hillary would know who was coming in. Right before me and my mom and dad was Jay Leno and his wife Mavis. And the guy said, Mr. President and Mrs. Clinton, please welcome Jay Leno and his wife Mavis. And then he said to me, after he introduced them and they went into the room, he said to me, can I have your name and your guest's name, please? And I said, oh, my name's Jeff Bungles. I'm the producer. They know who I am. These are my parents, Mr. and Mrs. Margolis. And so he said, okay, thank you very much. And I turned around and looked at my parents, and they had smiles from ear to ear. And I had a relationship with them. And I said, I looked at them and I said, you're going in to meet the president of the United States of America, and you wanted me to be a doctor. You know, and they grabbed me and hugged me, and we had a good laugh. And then the guy said, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton, please meet Jeff Margolis's parents. Anyway, that's my story.
It is wonderful. The book is called We're Live in Five, My Extraordinary Life in Television. We didn't even get to the rules, the Margolis rules, but that number one rule, which keeps coming up, it's great words to live by in any profession. Be kind. You exemplify that in your stories in the book. Jeff, it's a wonderful read, and it's been such a delight to talk with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That was awesome. Thank you again, Jeff.
It's my pleasure. Anytime you want me to come back, give me a call. I've done 17 of these. You were number 17. Oof. Listen to me. Between Us Boys. Seriously, I'm serious when I say this, with all honesty from my heart. You were the best.
Well, I thank you. That means a lot.
You were absolutely the best. You listened, you read the book, you listened to what I had to say, and you asked really, really good questions. And if I talk too much, I'm sorry.
Oh, I could have done another hour of this. It was great. Well, we will have you back on. This was wonderful. And those okay. kind words mean so much coming from you. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Right. Be well. Bye-bye
See
now.
See you soon. You be well, too.